Welcome to the podcast In the Flow, conversations with pioneers in pediatric heart failure and transplantation. My name is Neha Bansal, and I'm a pediatric heart failure and transplant cardiologist at Children's Hospital at Montefiore in New York City. I hope you guys enjoyed the previous episode with Dr. Lipschultz on the formation of the Pediatric Cardiomyopathy Registry. For the episode today, we have two exciting guests to speak with. The first one is Dr. Lori West. Dr. West is a professor in the Department of Pediatrics, Microbiology, and Pathology at the University of Alberta in Canada. She's a pioneer in the field of ABO-incompatible heart transplantation in infants. In 2001, Dr. West reported the first ever series of 10 infants who received ABO-incompatible heart transplantation in the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. Our second guest today is Dr. Simon Urschel. Dr. Urschel is an associate professor in the Department of Pediatrics at University of Alberta, and he's the clinical director of the Pediatric Cardiac Transplant Program at Stollery Children's Hospital. He has led the recent clinical efforts to focus on exploring the limits and boundaries of ABO-incompatible heart transplantation, as well as study the long-term outcomes in these patients from large data registries. Transplantation of hearts from ABO-incompatible donors is contraindicated in adults because of the risk of hyperacute rejection. Let's listen to our two experts today as to why this contraindication may not apply to newborns and infants, and how this field of ABO-incompatible heart transplantation has evolved over the years.
Dr. West, why don't you tell us a little bit about ABO-incompatible heart transplantation? Why is it so challenging? And how did you even come about with this idea?
Well, yes, this goes back a ways, of course, because we know that the first decision we make about any kind of a transplant patient when we're working them up for transplant is, what is their blood group? What is their ABO blood group? And that helps us understand usually the decision-making process as to which donors they will be compatible with. And that limits, by necessity, the number of donors that they will be able to receive or even be considered for. And it's the first decision we make usually in any kind of a transplant, and everything flows from there. Maybe it's helpful just to remind the audience that there are four major blood groups, and they're not all compatible with each other. And the reason they're not compatible is because we all make antibodies, so-called natural antibodies, to the blood groups that we are not. And so I'm a B individual, and so I make anti-A antibodies. A individuals make anti-B antibodies, and O individuals make antibodies against both A and B. And of course, AB individuals make neither of these antibodies. So it's those antibodies that if you, a donor and recipient pair, incompatible. And so what would happen if you transplanted an organ in the face of those antibodies? The ABO substances are expressed on the structure of the organ you're transplanting, and the antibodies in the circulation of someone who is incompatible would then latch onto those antigens in the structure and initiate a very rapid cascade of devastating immunologic reaction called hyperacute rejection, which very rapidly leads to destruction of the organ. So that's a pretty sensible rule to undertake. And for many years, since really the early years of kidney transplantation, it was recognized early on that if you crossed the ABO barrier and used an incompatible donor, that you would most of the time, not always, but most of the time, have this catastrophic reaction. And so it became a very early rule that not only would everybody have these antibodies, that you could make a generalization that everyone would have these natural antibodies to the blood structures they don't express, and that you should never cross this barrier. Okay, so that was the early rule. And when kidney transplantation, which was, of course, in the early days done solely in adults, was finally led to transplantation of other organs, especially the heart in the late 60s and into the early 70s, there was no reason to question those rules, right? So we would always exclude, for example, a blood group O recipient from receiving a blood group A heart because, of course, everybody whose blood group O would have anti-A antibodies. And so that would be a catastrophe. But why would we even think about needing to cross the ABO barrier? Well, because we don't have enough organs. We don't have enough donors. And when pediatric transplantation began to be performed in the 80s, in the 1980s, and then infant heart transplantation in the late 80s after Len Bailey's original baby Faye case in crossing the xeno barrier, again, the rules were never really questioned. And so generally speaking, the blood group barrier was always recognized as a major barrier that should not be crossed. And of course, the difference in heart transplantation is if you have a catastrophic immunologic injury because you've crossed the barrier, not only will your graft be irrevocably damaged, but your patient will die because you're not going to go back on, you don't have a dialysis equivalent that a kidney transplant patient who had an unsuccessful incompatible transplant go back on dialysis. That wouldn't be a possibility in heart transplantation. But we need more organs. So you're faced with this terrible dilemma. So how did we first start to think about this? When I took on a staff position at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto in the mid-90s, we had just, so remember, this is only a few years after Len Bailey's original cases of infant transplantation. And at the time, we had started to do infant heart transplantation. We hadn't done very many because the organs were so few and far between. The donors were so scarce. And indeed, in about 1995, our mortality rate for infants awaiting transplantation was in excess of 50%, close to 60% of babies would die waiting for an organ. And people may not remember or realize that at that time, the surgical palliation pathways for a single ventricle, especially hypoplastic left heart syndrome, were dismal. You know, they still were not good. And so basically, we offered all of our patients' families three options: nothing, a surgical pathway that had a very high mortality rate as well, or being listed for a transplant that most likely would never result in an organ.
And this is back in the 1990s, right?
Yes, yeah, so this would have been in about 1995. Mm-hmm. And so it was not, they were, you know, the worst heart disease, and there were very few options, and they were all pretty dismal, really. Right. And yet, those early days of infant transplants, if you were lucky enough to get an organ, those babies did really well, generally speaking. And even in Len Bailey's early cases, in one of his first transplants after the baby Faye case is still alive today. He's in his 30s today. And generally speaking, as we've come to understand more and more about the infant immune system and been able to perhaps back away a little bit from the aggressiveness of it, we've come to see that a baby who has their first surgical operation, a heart transplant, probably do better than anyone else. And certainly the data from the ISHLT registry bear that out, that the infants really have better survival, better long-term survival than patients who have a heart transplant at any later age. So here we are in the mid-90s in this terrible predicament. And I had come back from England, where I had done a PhD in transplant immunology at the University of Oxford. And I had understood a lot about the infant immune system because that's where my PhD work really was based. I also had the fortunate occurrence that I had a very close friend who was a hematologist back in England. And we used to talk a lot about hematologic issues and blood group antibodies. And it came up that, well, why do we have this barrier, this absolute contraindication to ever crossing this barrier? Do we ever even look at it? You know, and then I remember that, of course, babies, we know, if you're a pediatrician, you know that babies have a slower immune response in early life to polysaccharide structures, to carbohydrate structures, than to protein structures. And we know that because we immunize against them, right? So we know that at age, beginning even at 2 months or probably even earlier, that a baby will respond to stimulation by tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, and the other common protein antigen-based structures that we immunize them to. Mm-hmm. And we also know Back then, especially before we had more sophisticated conjugate vaccines, that they will not mount a similar response to pneumococcus. And that's why they remain so, those pathogens that have carbohydrate components remain so difficult for babies, for young babies. So we began to chat about these things, about the possibility, well, if that's the case, and if we know that babies don't make anti-blood group antibodies until later in the first year of life, and we know they can't respond very well to carbohydrate structures such as the blood group structures, then theoretically, why wouldn't you think about actually transplanting across the blood group barrier? Why wouldn't you even think about it? And so we began to think about it. And my friend Atherton and I kind of talked about it a lot. And then I guess we just started talking about it with the group at SickKids. We had very advanced thinking surgeons. They were keen to move transplantation forward. They were just as dismayed, you know, as we all are by the lack of organs. And we just began really talking about the science that underlies why this rule is there and potentially why it might not be applicable to certain age groups and to certain times of life. And it gradually became clearer that there really was not a scientific rationale to not consider crossing the ABO barrier in infancy before those antibodies develop. And that's how it really sort of came about. That's how we began thinking about it.
Yeah. So this is like a great example of what I said earlier in my podcast, that history is riddled with serendipitous collaborations. And I feel like your interaction with the hematologist and having great surgeons who were very open to working with you was really serendipitous and really exciting. Tell us a little bit about your first few ABO-incompatible transplants. I know you published your series in 2001 and published 10 patients. Tell us just a little bit about how that experience was. How were the families? Were they receptive? And how did you go about broaching the topic with them?
Well, so once we talked it through as a team, of course, and the surgeons were kind of game to proceed, then we kind of wrote it up. Well, it didn't evolve as a research protocol, as a research clinical protocol. It evolved more as a change in practice. And so there wasn't really exactly the same kind of research ethics board that we would propose this to today. There was an ethics committee that we met with and we talked it through. And then we kind of made sure it was written down with all of these factors that I've talked about included in how we did it. But, you know, at some point, sometime, one patient comes along. And we were very fortuitous in that the very first patient who ended up receiving and was the first one we proposed it to, was also quite a special patient and family. This was a family who had identified, and again, fetal echo at the time, of course, was much, much less sophisticated than it is now. But this baby, whose name is Caleb, was identified, his family was identified relatively early in the pregnancy as having hypoplastic left heart syndrome. And the mother underwent intrauterine procedure that also was much less sophisticated at the time to try and widen the aortic outflow tract. And I don't really know much about exactly what was done, but it was not a success, but neither was it it didn't disrupt the pregnancy either. And the pregnancy continued. But I was put in touch with this family, and this family was in a different part of Canada than we were. And apparently they were told that we didn't do heart transplants in infants in Canada, nowhere. And of course we hadn't done many because there weren't many donors. But somehow she and I were put in touch with each other. I was introduced to this family by one of their obstetrical colleagues, and we began to talk. And I told them that, yes, we do heart transplants in babies. I explained the whole problem with the lack of sufficient donors and so on. And I talked to her for a long time about the possibilities of considering crossing the ABO barrier to try and increase the likelihood of getting a donor for their baby. And we just talked it through. And then eventually, when her pregnancy reached 36 weeks, because we were listing patients at 36 weeks, they came to Toronto. We met them. We talked it through. We worked the baby up as far as you can. And he was listed for a transplant. And some weeks went by. And of course, all the time, we're also talking again with our ethics committees and our teams and so on. Right. And he was born, and there had been no donor offer. He was born and you know, he did okay for a week or so. And then 3 weeks went by and he hadn't been transplanted. And then we got a call, as you always do. You get a call.
Was it at 2 a.m?
No, actually, sometime in the afternoon. But, you know, as the weeks had gone by, we'd talked through again. what this was like. Everybody was on board. They were still, although, you know, anxious, they knew that the likelihood that they'd get a call at all was very slim. So we did get a call, and it was a blood group AB donor. And we sat down and talked about it. And I said, you know, we've talked this through already, and this is the day we were waiting for. And I think that as we've discussed for the last number of weeks and months, this is probably his best chance, because he was already starting to have some, you know, deterioration in his clinical status. And they went away and talked about it for a while, not too long, and came back and said, we think that, you know, we should go ahead with this.
So fantastic. And Caleb did fine afterwards?
He did. Yes. He's now 23 or so years old. So the transplant was set up. We had a lot of discussion in the operating room about what blood group, blood products should be used in the perfusion equipment. We had it, you know, we had as many things set up in advance as we could think about. So for example, I was the runner for the taking blood from the circuit down to the blood bank so that they could do a quick spin titer. You know, I hung over the table watching everything very closely because that's what we used to do anyway. But and it all proceeded really pretty well. I was terribly, terribly, you know, almost incapacitated by anxiety because as we went into the operating room, the surgeon in charge, who was Ivan Rebecca, put his hand on my shoulder and said, you better be right about this. We went through the night, and as we came out, and when they removed the cross clamp, you know, there were a couple of 10 seconds or so where nothing happened and anxiety rose. And, you know, you've been there though. And then the heart started and everything really was fine after that. There were no glitches at all. And as we came out of the operating room in the morning, which was Valentine's Day morning, 1996, of course, someone pointed that out. Maybe it was the parents who pointed that out, Harry and Rita. And really, he did very well over the years. He's done very, very well. There were a few small glitches, but clinically he's done really, really well. And then after that, after you do one, and every program, and Simon can talk about this too, every program that has taken it on finds that it's a much bigger barrier to think about and talk about and look at than it actually is to institute the protocols, which really are pretty simple. They're not that difficult once you get by all of this other stuff.
Yeah, I think recently we were reviewing our list of transplants at Montefiore Hospital here, and we did see that after we did one, there was a slew of at least three or four within a few years that were ABO incompatible. So I guess once you do one, there's comfort within the program, blood bank team, collaboration with everyone in the ICU, and the comfort that comes with that is so important. But I guess you just have to get over that barrier of doing the first ones.
You're right about the collaboration. Everybody on the teams, all the clinical teams, everyone needs to be aware of how this works. And so in the early days, we used to post, because if they were, for example, to get the wrong blood type blood product in the ICU afterward, everybody needs to know why. And so we used to post up these things, give only this blood type, red cells, give only this blood type, platelets and plasma and so on. And everybody's got to be aware that this is a little unusual and that they need to be, it's not that it's that difficult. They just need to be aware of how unusual it is. And I'll just add a personal note here. When we, not long after we first started doing these, I guess when we were preparing the first report, I was visiting Daphne Sue in New York, and I kind of mentioned it in passing. I said, well, yeah, we're doing these blood group incompatible transplants. And they kind of, everybody just shakes their head at that point and said, no, you don't actually mean that. You mean like incompatible size or HLA, something like that.
Right. Said,
no, actually, we're doing blood group incompatible transplants, and they've been going really well. Want to hear more about it?
Yeah, that's incredible. I remember mentioning that to one of our adult heart transplant trainees, and she was just shell-shocked. She was like, are you sure you mean ABO blood group incompatible? And I said, yes, absolutely. So, I mean, it's brilliant human endeavor. You're such a leader in the field. And I just wanted to talk a little bit with Simon at this point in time, because he led the recent paper with Pediatric Heart Transplant Society. Simon, what have been some of the changes over the years or recent learnings where we are today with the amazing accomplishment that Dr. West started?
And it's really actually quite amazing to see how things have evolved. Maybe I can start similarly with a quick personal note, because how I came across this whole thing is I was part of the first ABO-incompatible transplants that were done in Germany, so which were the first ones in Europe. And we were using Dr. West's protocol. It had Lori West written all over. And I was a resident at the time. But I had a background in immunology, and especially in B-cell immunology, looking at these polysaccharide vaccines and why children don't respond to it well. So I got very intrigued with that and touched base with Lori. And that gave me the opportunity to eventually work with her and understand so much more about B-cell immunology and about how this is possible. So I guess if we go historically in terms of following, so the original paper had 10 patients included. And then there was already, actually, interestingly, in the west of Canada at the same time, enthusiasm for it. So even from the mid-90s, I guess, after the information trickled through, people were starting doing ABO incompatibles across Canada, not only in Toronto, but also in Edmonton, which is the second large heart transplant center. And then Dr. Rebecca and eventually Dr. West went there and fully established this. Now, like I said, I had the big benefit of already having a pre-thought-out protocol of how to proceed with ABO incompatible. And after I had met Lori, it was quite funny too, because I had all these, I thought, oh, that's brilliant, because they think it has to be B-cell, T-cell independent B-cell immunology. So they use ATG to knock out the T-cells. So only the B-cells are around and get, you know, tolerized against this organ. And then Dr. West told me, oh no, that's just what we always did. So some of the things were still not very well understood and probably are not very well understood to this point. But it became increasingly clear that if you have this window of opportunity, which is the same window that children don't respond well to polysaccharides in vaccines, which is up to about 2 years or so, it seems pretty safe. And the really astonishing thing that Dr. West's group had already mentioned in the first publication, but then looked more in depth into, was that these antibodies against the donor blood group never seem to come up in a measurable or in a significant quantity. So we now have patients that are 25 years after ABO incompatible transplantation and still don't have antibodies against their donor blood group. So for example, if you have a blood group O recipient, they typically come up and they get an A heart, they typically come up eventually with anti-B antibodies, but never with anti-A antibodies. And we know even a young lady who's recently not taken her immune suppressive medication for 3 months and went into rejection and developed HLA antibodies, still throughout the whole process of rejection has not developed anti-A antibodies. So it is definitely something that changes in the immune system with that. And so I guess after Munich in Germany, the UK was the first big follower. And in 2006, I believe they published a case series of 21 patients between Newcastle and London. And then building on that, there was increasing interest in looking at that, but still a lot of skepticism, as always, if there's something new. And the US was actually fairly slow with adapting this process as well, and fairly restrictive in the beginning. So they would say, well, you can use it only if you have no blood group compatible recipient, and you can use it only secondary to blood group matching, and only in the first year of life, and only with titers up to 1 in 4, while in Canada and other places, we were already much more generous with that, just noticing that it works really well. In 2013, we did a multi-center study with 55 patients at the time, which included 3 US centers that were also pioneering this, and found that the outcomes are actually excellent, no worse than with compatible ones. At the same time, about Toronto had a long-term follow-up that showed graft vasculopathy is not more common, and also other complications are not worse. And based on that and increasingly available information that it's clinically safe, a lot of jurisdictions started to allow it more generously. And these most recent papers where we have used the Pediatric Heart Transplant Society study base to look into have two parts of it. And one looks just at the last 10 years, so basically up to 2018. And in that period, from initially about 35-40% of children in the first 2 years that were listed were ABO incompatible, and about 12% that actually received the ABO incompatible heart, it has increased in 2018 to now 70% of the kids being listed for ABO incompatible, and up to 40% in some years being transplanted with ABO incompatible heart. So it really has evolved into a mainstay approach in many places. Now, interestingly, Eurotransplant just recently has updated their criteria, and they still call it a research or experimental approach and still ask the centers to go for ethics application. Although in the meantime, we actually have found quite interesting things around clinical outcomes, which is not only do they have the same survival or do they have the same freedom from graft vasculopathy and tumors, but they actually have fewer rejections than the ones that get an ABO-compatible organ. And to our big surprise, we also found that they had fewer infections, because with the whole shift in the immune system, we were always worried that if they become more tolerant to this blood group, maybe they are also less aggressive about polysaccharide encapsulated bacteria. So they would be at risk of Haemophilus influenza, pneumococcus, meningococcus infections. But to our surprise, it actually turns out now that we have big enough data to compare that they have fewer of those infections, including specifically the polysaccharide encapsulated bacterial infections, than there were before. So it seems to be a clinically safe approach, at least for this patient group where it's generally accepted, which is, I guess, pretty much everywhere in the first year of life. We accept titers up to 1 in 32, which is our boundary. The real boundaries still have to be determined, especially in regards to age and titers and what can you do if you have an older patient that has lower titers. So for example, in our center, we had a 4.5-year-old and a 6-year-old now, that one of them had primarily still low titers. The other one dropped their titers when we were desensitizing her for HLA reasons. And eventually we said, well, she should be safe to get an ABO-incompatible transplant. And we've done that. That's now 1.5 years ago. And she has, similar to the young children, not come up with any antibodies against her donor organ. It's not encountered any rejection, nothing else. Her B cells have fully recovered. She's off immune globulin supplementation, so it's doing perfectly well. But that's still kind of the unexplored or uncharted territory. So those are the questions for the future, I guess.
Dr. West started this really incredible journey, and then you've obviously like studied it and moved the field forward. And so next step would be how aggressive we can get and how much we can push the envelope in the future. So, you know, just looking at how far we've come along, what is next? Where do we go from here, Dr. West or Dr. Urschel?
I'm sure Simon will have some thoughts about that. I think there are, so a couple of things. I think it's very interesting to hear of the continued hesitation in adopting something like this. And I would just say in the strongest possible words that there are many maybe practical reasons why you wouldn't want to change a practice, but there is no scientific reason to consider ABO-incompatible heart transplantation unreasonable in the infant population. There's just no scientific rationale to deny them. And in fact, the ABO question really is irrelevant in early infancy. If there are no antibodies, then to oblige a program to continue accepting blood group matched, sometimes identical and then compatible grafts makes no scientific sense and really puts those infants at risk and at a disadvantage. The future, I think, and I'm sure Simon will have lots of thoughts about this too. The future, I think the, one of the cases that Simon just mentioned where the response to desensitization for HLA sensitization and the impact of that on ABO antibodies and the possibilities of how that opens a doorway for, you know, what are now our most difficult patients, which are the ones with very high HLA antibodies. I think that's a wonderful pathway that we need to explore more and more. We've developed now, as I'm sure the audience knows, when you're dealing and trying to figure out HLA sensitization, you've got tools that measure HLA antibodies with great finesse and sophistication, down to every molecule of them, and the specificities and the isotypes and their complement binding ability. In this day and age, 120 years after Landsteiner won the Nobel Prize for discovering the four main blood groups through a process of agglutination, we still use as our only clinical tool out there to detect and characterize ABO antibodies, we still use some variation of an agglutination test. That is really, it's known to be a flawed test. It's known to be, have many, many difficulties with it. And yet we still accept this. So I think one of the main things that may allow us to move forward is the development of more sophisticated assays for ABO antibodies. And we've just developed a Luminex bead assay, similar to what we use for HLA antibody characterization for ABO antigens, working with the chemists that we've been working with for a number of years. We hope that offers a new tool to help really look at pushing this forward in other ways. That's one that I see, but I know that Simon has lots of thoughts about this too.
Yeah. So first of all, as you mentioned, that was one of the outcomes of one of the papers that we have recently published as well. And it shows that their wait time is significantly shorter than if you have only ABO compatible listing. So definitely it has made a difference and it has probably brought patients to organs that may not otherwise have had that gift of surviving. Now, the question is really, is it something unique about infancy or could we achieve the same naivety or immaturity later again in life? And what really is the boundary? Now, even if we deplete B cells later in life, we'll probably never get back to the same situation of having no fully evolved spleen and fully evolved lymph nodes and all the other components of the immune system that have learned a lot in the meantime. So just depleting B cells is maybe not enough, but we do have some evidence that it may be successful. It's not only our own experience and the experience from the UK with pushing the boundaries and using older patients for that. Actually, in the PHTS database, we had 27 patients that we did not include in the main analysis that were older than 2 years at the time of transplant, and they had a more than 80% 10-year survival as well. So that's no worse than what you would expect in ABO compatibles. And then there's a really interesting analysis that has just looked into those patients in adults in the ISHLT registry that had accidentally received an ABO incompatible organ. And they had a fairly high early mortality of about 30%. But once they were beyond this first few weeks to months, they actually had the same survival as anybody else. So if the centers would have been prepared and wouldn't have accidentally done this, maybe they could have bridged them through these first weeks and been equally successful. And that was actually intentionally done in two patients in Sweden, published in 2012, where they chose patients that had low titers to start with, pre-treated them, and then successfully. I think that's really one of the key questions. Can we manipulate with some ways, maybe more surgical than just depleting all B cells or doing something like that, the more mature immune system in a way that they are more receptive for ABO incompatible transplant? And that's not the only thing, because as Dr. West mentioned, infants also, as we all know, have by far the best long-term survival of any heart transplant, any age group, and now have a conditional survival of already 35 years, 50% in the ISHLT registry if they've come through the first year. And if we take the current numbers and extrapolate that, maybe we're looking at 40 or more years that they can live with their transplant, which is 3 times as much as an adult would. So there's definitely some benefit in the immaturity. And I think that's really one of the big goals. How can we transfer these benefits to older patients without at the same time putting them at risks that may be involved with having a less mature immune system?
Maybe I could just add, if you don't mind, and to make it even more interesting, that cohort of adults who would have received accidental transplants, of course, because they were not known at the time, they would have been using blood products that gave them even more antibodies, because they would not have been using the appropriate, you know, like AB plasma, which has no anti-A or anti-B. So if it was an O patient, they would have been given blood products containing anti-A and anti-B, which would have made the whole situation much, much worse. So it's certainly not a surprise that there's a reluctance to do adults. But if you look at the adult ABO incompatible kidney literature, you know, they do as well as the compatible patients. And so I think there is a lot of room still to explore the adult populations, the more mature populations, who actually may have more malleability to them than we really understand. And I might just go back to the fact that once we have tools to look at this, we may be able to understand that a lot better and try and understand why is it that some ABO incompatible kidney transplants remain unpredictable. There's an unpredictability about it, but I think that's because we can't assess the risks accurately because the tools are so poor.
So better tools, pushing the envelope, older patients, hopefully. So lots to look forward to. It's really incredible that ABO heart transplantation that actually evolved initially from a desperate attempt to save patients who were otherwise going to die has now evolved into such a path-breaking field. So thank you so much for your time and your expertise in the field. We really learn from hearing backstories and where we are going to be, you know, in the future. Any last minute closing thoughts that you guys wanted to share?
I would just say that something that Simon mentioned earlier is, you know, the amazing survival of patients transplanted in infancy, especially if it's their primary approach to their usually congenital, not always, but often congenital heart disease, especially now when we look at the long-term survival of Fontan patients, and we see that the decisions that we make at that first time point and the outcomes of the Fontan pathway and how really inferior they are to a long-term infant heart transplant patient who's had a primary transplant. And we have to remember that those decisions really, although yes, you can do a transplant later in life after a Fontan has failed, that those patients are nowhere near as immunologically privileged or malleable as the infant is. I think Simon pointed that out really well.
I just have a word of practical advice because Lori mentioned putting up the signs at the bedside to make clear what blood group it is and what blood product should be used. That has not changed over the last 20 years. We still put those signs up. Because even with all the experience people have in the heat of the moment, sometimes things get lost. And so I think that's a really key point, especially if people, you know, come up, you'll always face a lot of skepticism in your programs if you come up with something new. And as Dr. West said, you may get a hand on the shoulder and people say, oh, you better be right about this. So it's always really good to have a meticulous protocol set up and think of as much as possible, you know, pitfalls that could happen and have little sheets, although it looks ridiculous, but it actually prevents accidents.
Absolutely. In our EMR, we actually have a sticky note as soon as you open the patient's chart. Tricks like, of course, bedside. Nothing's better than the bedside, or like your notes in the EMR. So I guess just a collaborative approach where you work with the nurses at bedside, educate them, you work with your blood bank and educate them and get them all involved in the care of your patient, I think, is always the best approach. I think there are centers around the country still that do not feel that they're ready yet to take on the challenge. But hearing all of you talk, you know, it just takes one courageous leader to make one bold attempt and look at where we are today, like Dr. Urschel pointed, and how we're looking forward to the future. Thank you so much for sparing the time to speak with me and telling me your backstories and your current stories. I really appreciate the time. I know everyone listening to the podcast is going to walk away feeling very enriched today. And thank you so much for doing this for us.
Happy to help.
All right, thank you.
What an incredible episode. I would like to thank Dr. West and Dr. Urschel for explaining the evolution of ABO-incompatible heart transplantation. It has become clear that for heart transplantation in early life, the ABO blood groups are almost irrelevant. Given the positive impact of ABO-incompatible heart allocation on decreasing the wait times, waitlist mortality, and their comparable long-term outcomes, it is increasingly difficult to justify not embracing this approach today. We are so proud to hear that Dr. West was recently appointed as an officer of the Order of Canada, one of the nation's highest honors. It is awarded by the Governor General and recognizes outstanding achievement, dedication to the community, and service to the nation. Dr. West has been recognized for her leadership in transplantation and donation, particularly for her breakthrough research in infant heart transplantation. Interestingly, Dr. West also initiated the History Project with the ISHLT to collect reminiscences and thoughts from pioneers in the field of heart transplantation, very similar to the aim of this podcast. I will be providing the link to her episode of a video interview with Dr. Leonard Bailey in the episode description. Please do check it out if you're interested in this field. I would like to thank you all for listening. If you wish to get in touch with me, please email me at intheflow.peds@gmail.com. I hope you will join me in the next episode. And until next time, namaste.